Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace.
John Paul here.
And this is your X Tuesday episode for this week. And today we're going to be talking about, well, certainly up to this point, what is the most important issue of the whole House of X Powers of 10 series. I mean, this is the one that really sort of explains how things are the way they are. Because, you know, as we talked about in the previous two episodes covering the first issue of each of those series, this sort of comes out of the blue. It's not really an acknowledgement of how this sort of different world, different timeline of the X-Men is happening. So in this one, we discover something about a longtime X-Men ally, I'll call her. And it really, it's really very interesting, the idea they come up with. Now, I'm not complaining whatsoever about being spoiled. It's 100% my fault. I wasn't reading these in real time, even though I wanted to. I was all caught up with X-Men during the X-Men Disassembled, and I just fell behind during the Age of X-Man, and I wasn't. And I still had plenty of time to get caught up, but you know, life and day job and all that kind of thing. So I actually was a little bit spoiled. I knew that it had something to do with this character. I heard some things. You know, it's impossible not to be as involved in comics as I am and not hear things. So I do kind of wish that I had read it like the day that it came out, or preview copy even before it came out or what have you, because I would have liked to have had that experience cold. That being said, when I read this issue, it still was like, I wasn't blown away like I would have been otherwise, but it still was like, oh yeah, this is a pretty cool idea. So did you read this the day that it came out, John Paul?
Yeah, I did. Once the series was announced, I made sure I put in my order.
Yeah.
So I got it the day of, and I read it like almost immediately after I got it.
You remember your initial reaction?
I was like, whoa, I did not see that coming. But then I thought about it. It's like, well, she does spend a lot of time around mutants, more so than most humans do, without any problem. So, and then somebody brought out something about X-Men history that I didn't know, that the legacy virus affected her.
Yeah.
And that supposedly only affected mutants.
Right.
So I guess it makes sense.
Yeah. The character we're talking about is Moira MacTaggert, right? So longtime X-Men ally, former romantic interest of Charles Xavier, the mother of Legion, if anybody's familiar with Legion from like the FX show or what have you. And we always just thought, I mean, it was never, she never manifested any powers, at least not that we saw. So nobody ever really thought of her as a mutant. And that sort of gets completely flipped on its head here in House of X issue two. And we'll talk about it in a second. But one of the things it does bring up, I always find this to be an interesting kind of thought experiment. Like, technically, a mutant is somebody whose, you know, DNA has mutated, and specifically in the case of the X-Men, they've got this X gene, is what they call it, and that allows them to manifest some sort of powers, right? So a mutation means, by definition, it's spontaneously changed, right? Their parents don't have powers, and they have powers. But now you're talking about in the case of Legion, technically speaking, he's not a mutant, possibly. You know, it may be that the reason he's an Omega level mutant is because his X gene has mutated even beyond what was passed on to him by his mother. But again, I mean, I don't even know that it necessarily matters. But it's just interesting to think about. So, you know, if I mean, for the same reason, you wouldn't think of Cable necessarily as a mutant, because technically both his parents are mutants and they just pass that X gene along. Nothing is actually mutated, technically speaking, in his DNA. So just a food for thought. But the cover is a really cool looking cover. It's made up of a bunch of triangles, and sort of in the middle six triangles, you see all these different versions of Moira MacTaggert. And then in various other triangles, you see different versions of characters that play a role in the book at various times. So we've got Destiny, we've got Professor X, we have Mystique, we see Pyro, Blob, Cyclops, Wolverine, who else is on here? Jean Grey, Apocalypse. So again, it's a very interesting story, and we're going to go ahead and dive right in. So it starts off with one of those text pages. It says, if you can find it in you to survive, if you are worthy, then I will make you into something more than them, something eternal. And that quote is from Apocalypse. And as you're reading this, you're like, well, who the heck is he talking about, right? If you're just flipping it open for the first time. So on the first page, we see a girl in a bed, a young girl, and we're told it's Moira. She's 13 years old. She's sick. Fever is really high, unnaturally so. Doctor's prognosis is not hopeful. And the next day, almost miraculously, we're told she's better than ever. Right as rain, we see her running around outside, and she's fine. We're told years later she would marry. She'd become a school teacher. She'd have two boys, Callum and Dean, and one girl, Abigail. No mention of David, who's Legion. But there's a family picture there. And this clearly is not the Moira we know, right? Like, wait, she didn't have David. She just became a school teacher. And there's a picture of, you know, her and her family. It says they would in turn have 8 children of their own. And to Moira's great joy, once a year, every year, the extended family would return home. And then Moira died at age 74, passing away peacefully in her sleep, a good life, a human life, and not extraordinary at all. And so right away, I'm like, okay, I don't remember ever seeing anything about her being sick as a child. And certainly this doesn't mention her going to Oxford, meeting the X-Men, being a part of that world at all. Like, I was wondering, like, what the heck's going on? And the next page is when it's sort of revealed, right? Moira's second life, it says, began in utero. So she's sentient in her mother's womb, right? A fully sentient being, which is strange enough, but also the fact that she remembers her entire prior life. And so, again, you know, because it was spoiled for me a little bit, I had kind of expected this, but it's still an interesting thing to think about. Because the first thing you think was, well, how horrible would that be to be trapped for 9 months in your own mom? Like, I wouldn't have the patience. I didn't have the patience to wait 9 months anyway, or 10 months, or whatever it is. I was born early. So, but we do get a little quote here from Moira who kind of addresses that. She says, yeah, you'd think being aware and trapped in your mother would be lead you to madness. But actually, you know, with child rearing comes a certain kind of bliss, which I can, you know, as a parent, I can vouch for that. She calls it an embryonically induced neuroleptic zen via biology. So she said, yeah, I felt safe. I felt happy. You know, your mother's your home. It's once you're out in the world that you start losing your mind. So in her second life, she's born. And this is more the Moira we know. This timeline and this lifetime, I guess you'd call it, is something that sounds much more familiar. Because obviously, if you're born with the knowledge of your previous life, that would be a huge advantage, right? And it says here that Moira's parents began to believe she was special, and not just the way every parent thinks their kid is special, but, you know, she learned to walk very early and speak very early. She was just born knowing how to do things, because again, she had all the knowledge of her past life. She still had to wait for her body to catch up, right? Her physical development to catch up to her mental levels, and, you know, physical coordination, hand-eye coordination and all that, but she still was, you know, way ahead of the game. And she wasn't necessarily special because she was something new. And at the time, you know, mutants weren't known, you know, they weren't widely known, this idea of mutants. And even Moira herself, she didn't know it at the time, but she was a mutant. So that's what we're told in the first couple pages here. So an interesting power to have. And I don't know, like, you think about all the different mutant powers to have. I don't know that this is one that I would like to have. You know, having to grow up over and over. I don't know. That doesn't strike me as something that's that would be real pleasant for me, just my personality, the way that I am. What about you, John Paul? What did you think when you read that? Did you think, oh, that would be cool to be able to go back and fix mistakes? I mean, I see that part, but I don't know. I don't think I'd want to do it. How about you?
Well, after the first time, probably, but like keep going, probably not. Well, that's why I like this panel at the bottom. with her as a child. I don't know if boredom has ever been captured better than that.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly, man. Like, I just wouldn't have the patience for that. Like, I'd be, if you have the knowledge, you know, but your body's not allowing you to do things. Yeah, that would be tough. I'd be willing to put up with it if it meant that I had immortality and I would live forever and be able to see things, but that's not even the case for her. Every time she's, and I want to make this point, because I'm not sure how this works, because usually when people think about reincarnation, you think, okay, the whole idea of you're reincarnated into some other type of creature based on how you lived your life previously. So if you were a scumbag, you come back as like a snail, you know, and if you were, you know, a really good person, you come back and you're born into a, like a rich family or something like that. But you die and then you're born, you know, sometime later, and the timeline keeps moving on. When Moira is born, she keeps jumping back in time. It's not like she's moving forward in time. You know, it's not like she's living a lifetime. She dies in 1970 and then she's born again in 1971. And then she dies in, you know, whatever, 2020. And then she's born in 2021. No, she goes back. She goes back. That's what's really like, you can kind of understand it the other way around. Like her, you know, her, who she is, takes over or is, you know, reincarnated, is a spark or whatever at that moment of birth. And it's her again, but this idea that keeps going back, the time travel aspect that's inherent in it is what is makes it seem like it, there's a lot of power. I mean, they're all impossible powers, but there's some you can kind of say, okay, well, this is how it would actually happen in science. You know, maybe you could really have super strength or what have you. Or you could have immortality if your cells just didn't, you know, decay and die and wear out. Those you can kind of make concessions for how scientifically with the knowledge that we have, we could see how it happened. This is like so fantastical that it's really sort of out there. So definitely a very Jonathan Hickman type idea. And obviously he's the writer for the book. On the next page, we get the credits. Pepe Larraz is the artist. Marte Garcia handles the colors, Clayton Cowles on letters, Tom Muller on design. And we're told this is House of X, issue 2, The Uncanny Life of Moira X. We get a text page next, and there's a lot of text pages that give a lot of information, more so than the first issue of House of X. So we're told that in her early years, Moira had to be very careful not to let on what was really going on. She had to hide what was the knowledge that she had from her previous life. Technically she knew more than her parents, right? Her mind was older than the humans who had conceived her. So again, it's that time travel aspect. And obviously they were very proud of her because she was special and, you know, developed so quickly, but she had to be careful not to let on too much too fast to let them know, because then she instinctively knew that maybe that would turn into fear, right? Like, how could she know this? Maybe she's possessed. Maybe there's, you know, something going on that they're worried about. So she did try to hide as much as she could, but it's impossible to really conceal at some point, you know, to John Paul's point, you're just bored, right? And you want to just do the things you know how to do. And that had to lead to some suspicions in the text here, to quote the text, her teachers began to use words like advanced and clever, which led to other words like brilliant and prodigy. And, you know, when you're in that situation, you're obviously going to get pushed into a life of academia, a life of the mind. So even though in her first life, Moira was just a school teacher, you know, think about how much knowledge you could accumulate if you could live, you know, life after life after life. Everything you learned in your first life, you take, plus you're just compounding each time. And Moira, you know, she didn't fight those efforts. She wanted to understand who and what she was as well. And she'd exhausted all the possibilities that her first life had offered. So she didn't really have a choice but to sort of move on beyond that first life where she was just a school teacher and kind of the matron of this extended family. So that's when she decided, hey, let me go to Oxford University, where she meets people that, you know, are much further along in terms of ideas and philosophy and concepts, interesting people. And eventually, after consideration of her own, at that time, unknown condition, because remember, mutants weren't really a thing that people were aware of, she decided to sort of concentrate her studies in the area of psychology and biology. So let me understand the workings of the mind. Let me understand the workings of the body. So she ran some experiments to prove that her memories weren't just some, you know, psychosis. I mean, for all she knew, she had schizophrenia, right? These delusions of grandeur or just, you know, complete fabrications in her mind. So she remembered that there were specific personal historical markers from her first life. And, you know, she would from memory know, okay, this particular event's going to happen at this particular time. And so as those sorts of events were about to unfold, she would do one of two things. She would either just let them play out as, you know, just passively not do anything different than her first life to see what would happen. And what would happen would be those events would happen exactly as she remembered them. They would play out exactly as she suspected. So in that way, it's proving that the memories that she has of this previous life are true, because if she just allows events to take their course, they happen exactly as she remembers them in her first life. But if she actively did something different, you know, if she remembered being at a certain place at a certain time, and then she was sure to not be at that certain place at that certain time, then things would change. Her life would be different. The path of her life would diverge from the previous life. So that was the way she sort of proved to herself that she wasn't crazy. You know, she wasn't just thinking, okay, well, I have schizophrenia or I have some sort of mental illness or, you know, this is really happening to me. Although I suppose the argument could be made that maybe she was, they weren't necessarily memories so much as her like seeing into the future. That's not really addressed. Like, what if she just had the power of precognition and she didn't actually live before, she just remembered it? Although I suppose you could say, well, but then she starts changing things and you wonder how much can she change and then still have those historical events happen. At some point, you're going to change so much stuff that the whole rest of your life is going to diverge and you won't be able to test anymore because you won't have any of those historical markers. So again, it's not a perfect fit when we talk about what Hickman has done here. But I mean, I think it still works for the most part. What do you think, John Paul?
You know, when I think too much about it, I start to poke holes in it, because you can't completely wrap your head around that kind of power set. But, but if you take it at face value, which, you know, me kind of as an analytical person, is difficult to do at times, it definitely works for the story to make it more interesting.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. It's one of those concepts and power sets that, yeah, you can't, don't think about it too much because, yeah, you can nitpick it apart where it doesn't make sense. But hey, don't do that. This is just comics. And this is, again, the problem is the time travel aspect. And, you know, there's just about any time travel story that I've ever read or seen or watched or heard of that if you poke at it long enough, you're going to poke holes in it, because time travel just, it as a concept, it just doesn't seem to work. There's too many paradoxes that will happen. So, but we do see on the next page that Moira is sort of talking about that second life. And she talks about, hey, who wouldn't want to go back and fix all the mistakes they made? But then again, there's the whole idea of the observer effect. You know, even when she's trying to be passive and just let things play out to prove her theory, there's the whole idea that just by watching something, you could be changing the outcome. So she's trying to figure out, is this a gift that I've been given? Is it a blessing? And eventually what she settled on was it was a curse. She didn't like the fact that this was happening to her, because she had had this great, wonderful life that she was happy in her first time around with this loving extended family. And, you know, she died peacefully in her sleep at a, you know, very ripe old age. And it seemed to be a good life. And now here she is trying to live her life again. But what happens when you live your life and you meet this person you're supposed to spend the rest of your life with and have spent the rest of your life with before, but you already know every mistake they're going to make, every flaw they possess, you know, you've been there, you've done that, you know, they're never going to change. And so that sort of destroyed any chance Moira had of just repeating her original life over and over again. And the phrase that Hickman uses, which I don't know that I necessarily agree with this concept, and I don't know that I ever have, but it's certainly appropriate here. He says, a familiarity breeds contempt, and her once husband could see it in her eyes. So, you know, she couldn't hide the fact that she knew his flaws and she knew the mistakes he was going to make. She remembered it, you know, every fight and this and that. So there's no family, there's no extended family, there's no children in the yard laughing and playing. And so you can't help but understand why she thought this would be a curse. And so she's thinking, well, could there be others in the world like me that are having their lives ruined just like me? And it says that she saw a man on television, someone she had a faint memory of, someone she'd met in school, and that man would be Charles Xavier. So we get a scene here with Professor X where he goes on television and he basically explains the concept of mutants, you know, which is an event that happened in the Marvel Universe. I think it was even shown in X-Men First Class, the movie. You know, I believe the shadows are no place for angels to hide. You know, giving up my secret identity, it's ill-fitting clothes. Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Charles Xavier, known as Professor X. I'm a mutant. And when Moira hears this, she kind of realizes, oh, maybe I'm a mutant too, right? Maybe that's what this is. And so she realizes that she needs to talk to this man and find out for sure. So she jumps on the first flight she could get to America. And on the way there, the plane crashes in the ocean and she dies. So there's the end of that second life, which I find interesting that, you know, later on we find out and we'll get there that she doesn't necessarily have infinite lives. And Hickman, he just like checks them off, I guess, to raise the stakes, to show that she can't just keep trying this over and over and over. But it was just so abrupt. Like, she's just starting to maybe understand, hey, I'm a mutant. Hey, maybe I can get some answers from Professor Xavier. And then Hickman just in the next panel just kills her. So I was like, wait, what? She died? Okay. I don't know. There's not that many plane crashes that happen. You would think, okay, well, you could figure out the timeline and was there actually a, but you know, Hickman's not necessarily that kind of writer where he's going to, you know, go and look up a crash and say, okay, it happened at this time, to tie it into real world events. And that's fine. So what happens? Well, of course, Moira goes back in time, reborn again. And this time when she's at Oxford, she actively seeks out Xavier. You know, she dives into a life of science much sooner. She realigns her interest to focus on anthropology and genetics. And she knew that Charles hadn't come out yet, like he had on the television in her second life. So she's there before he's revealing these things. And that's allowing her to see him in a different way. But it's not necessarily a flattering way. She has a distaste for him. He seems to be arrogant and have some sort of God complex. And she doesn't trust him. And so she decides against revealing herself to him. Like, she doesn't want to take that chance. So while she was able to learn things from him, she decided that he wasn't the answer that she was looking for. And maybe that's why Hickman kills her off in her second life, to do a third life here, so that she can discover this much sooner in her life. Because who knows what would have happened if she had gone in that second life and talked to Xavier, met him at a different time, what would have happened? Because I find it so interesting, because you have heard those things about Xavier before. Like, there's the whole idea of him as not a good guy, as not a hero, you know, the whole Onslaught thing. There's that, you know, part of him that is, that does have a God complex, that does think he's better than everybody else. So, I don't know. I kind of go back and forth on it. When he was first created, you know, he was the benevolent mentor in the wheelchair and couldn't walk, and you felt bad for him because he couldn't walk, but he still ordered those kids around, you know, at a very young age and put them in danger. You have people that say, well,
that's not a hero, having other guys, you know, having kids fight his battles and putting them in danger. So it's interesting. Hickman is playing with that gray area. So yeah, Moira decides Xavier's not the answer. He's just suffering from a disease is how she thinks of it, rather than a mutation. She's thinking of the whole idea of the X gene as a cancer, right? And she's going to spend the rest of her life trying to cure the world of it. So that's what she decides to do with her third life. Do you have any thoughts, John Paul, on her meeting Xavier sooner in this third life and that idea that he's arrogant and, you know, God complex and not somebody that she should confide in?
Oh, yeah, I can kind of see where she's coming from, because he does, even in this series, kind of give off that sentiment, that feeling, some here and there. So the whole plane crash thing, though, I don't, it kind of took me by surprise. It was all in just one panel too.
Yep.
But I see where she's coming from.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. What's funny is that Xavier that she describes, when she says the arrogance of Xavier's ideas and what she felt was a thinly disguised God complex, I feel like that's the way that Jim Shooter wrote Professor X, if you go back and read Marvel Superhero Secret Wars. So it's not unprecedented for him to just be a total dick at times. And one thing I want to mention right here while I'm thinking about it before I forget, something to do with the art. There are various times in the artwork where there's literally thumbprints in the background in the shading. And I don't know if that's Pepe Larraz purposely using his own thumbprints. I don't know if it's Hickman throwing them in there for some reason. I don't know if it's Marte Garcia, the colorist, who's doing it for one reason or another, but there's just various times where I'm like, man, that sure the heck looks like a thumbprint in the background, in the, in like the shading. So, if you look at the page, I'm looking at it digitally. It says it's page 10, but I'm not sure. But if you look at it between Xavier and Moira back on the wall, the shading there, it sure the heck looks like there's a thumbprint there. And then far to the left on that panel. And this is the panel that starts with in Moira's third life. On the left-hand side, the shading, again, it looks like a giant thumbprint. So I don't know if you had ever noticed that, John Paul. Do you see what I'm talking about?
Not really. You sure it's not a thumbprint on your screen?
I'm positive it's not a thumbprint on my screen. So in the panel that says in Moira's third life, she aggressively dove into a life of science, blah, blah, blah. Right there next to Xavier's hand, just to the right of his hand, on the wall between him and Moira, that shading, that doesn't look like a fingerprint to you?
I'm not seeing that.
And then all the way over on the left-hand side of that same panel, the shading looks like a thumbprint.
Well, it might have been corrected, because I have the collected edition.
Oh, gotcha.
So I'm not sure. Yeah.
Okay. If I share my screen, can you see it?
Sure.
Okay, I'm going to share my screen just to see if you... Okay. So do you see here? And right here.
Yeah, that's really dark in my book.
Huh. That's interesting.
So it's much darker in my book.
Huh. So yeah, maybe they did correct it. Okay. I'm just curious, because, you know, again, it's a Hickman book, and you can never count anything out with a Hickman book. So maybe... Right. Maybe the colorist was just using his finger.
Oh, I totally see it.
Yeah.
Yeah. See what I'm totally saying? See it. I don't, my single issues are in the box, so I wouldn't be able to see that, because they definitely made it darker here.
Yeah. Very, very interesting. Anyway, maybe it's not a thing, but again, it's Hickman, so you can never count anything out. So I wanted to mention it before I forget. Anyway, to go on, with Moira's story of her third life here, you know, she's decided that, yeah, mutation is a cancer. She's going to cure it. So, you know, again, she's previously studied psychology and biology. Now in this life, she's studied genetics and anthropology. So very well suited, has the knowledge, and is able, after years of research and experimentation, to find a way to eliminate what she considers the cursed mutant gene. But before she's able to use it, her and her team are taken out. So we turn the page and we're told she never got a chance to use it. She wasn't allowed to. And we see that Destiny and Mystique are there. Now, these are two very powerful mutants who frequently work together. Destiny, a very, very long-lived mutant who can see the future. Mystique, a shape changer and a very capable, you know, fighter. She's very good with using weapons and that sort of thing. And Destiny is looking at Moira. Everybody else looks like they've already been killed, everybody from her scientific team. And Destiny's looking at Moira saying, you know, it's interesting. I can't see her at all. I can see the world bending around her, but she's just like an absence, like a hole there that shouldn't be. A mutant who's invisible to other mutants. And this obviously has to do with the fact that Moira reincarnates. And so Destiny says it's a defense mechanism, I suppose, although not much of a good one if you know what you're looking for. Kind of the same thing with Superman and lead, right? You try to hide something in lead, it actually has the opposite effect, because then he can just X-ray vision everything and the lead's going to stand out. This is kind of the same thing. You don't see her. She's not visible to other mutants. But if you then start looking for that absence, that hole, then it becomes super conspicuous because it's not there. You look for the emptiness, if you will. But if you're not specifically looking for it, you may not realize that the hole is even there. And so they basically tell Moira, look, you've made a big mistake here, right? I have the ability to see the future. And that can be tricky with somebody like you, with your mutant power of reincarnation. And you might think it's impossible for somebody to see your future because you're going to keep reincarnating and having different futures. But I can see all the futures, all the potentials that you have. And I want you to see me. I'm here right now in front of you. And Moira doesn't want to hear it. She's like, you killed all my friends. You killed everyone I know. And if you're going to kill me, just, you know, kill me and get it over with. And Mystique's like, don't worry, we will. But it doesn't do us much good to kill you now if we just have to do it all over again next time. So we're going to drop some knowledge on you first before before we kill you. That way you can take it into the next life. And she says, Destiny has a word for you. And that word, in fact, is knowledge. That was an inadvertent pun by me. And she says, yeah, it's such a gift, knowledge. That's what you're taking from each time you die. You take your knowledge that you gained in this life and all your previous lives into the next one. But you're using that knowledge to betray your own kind, to betray other mutants. And, you know, obviously Destiny and Mystique have always been on the side of fighting for mutants. You know, even when you talk about, are they really villains? Are they not? I mean, they were part of the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants, several different incarnations. They've worked with Magneto. They're on the side of, hey, mutants need to be safe, and they're willing to cross any line, you know, in order to make that happen. I wouldn't call them out and out villains. Maybe they're, you know, radicalized mutants, if you want to think about them like that. But they certainly don't see mutants the way Moira does. And she tells them that. She goes, it's a disease what we are. Like, being a mutant is a disease. And I'm not trying to force my cure on anyone. If people want the cure, though, they'll be able to take it, which I fully agree with the perspective that Destiny has here and Mystique shares it, I'm sure. You can think that, but that's awfully naive, because there's no way the powers that be, if they become aware of this cure, that they're not just going to shove it on to everybody. And the way Destiny puts it is, she goes, you think this stops at want? They're going to let you keep and control what you made? Do you have any idea how much they hate us? The humans are going to come for you. They're going to break the chain, and they're going to take your cure, and they're going to wipe us out. They're going to eliminate our entire race. But Destiny says, but I see in you, you know, I see all these different possibilities that you could have. And some of them, you do really good work. And some of them, you know, not so much. And Moira's like, well, how exactly do you think you're going to stop me? And Destiny says, well, you know, my powers, I have the full knowledge of what's been done in the past, and I can see the future. And so if you are reincarnated and you decide that you're going to repeat this work and do this again, then I will find you again. And if you try to kill me, I will see you coming and I will prevent my death and I will kill you. So now that I have seen your potential futures, and now that we know and are aware of each other, we're joined together. And I'm going to be out here waiting to make sure that this version of you doesn't happen again. So your choice is change your path or die. Help your people, or I just continue to kill you if you choose to take this path. And you can see Moira's not happy about it. You know, she has her jaw set. She's pretty pissed off. And Mystique says, I don't know if she's buying this. She might need a little bit more encouragement. And so Destiny says, well, very well. You're a really smart woman and you've reincarnated several times and you're starting to believe that you're in some eternal loop and you're just going to keep reincarnating forever and you have some version of immortality. Well, I'm telling you that that's not the case. I see maybe 10 more lives for you, 11 if you make the right choice at the end of one of them, but that's it. And that you can see the shock and surprise. Great panel by Pepe Larraz. You see the shock and surprise on Moira's face. She's like, wait, how's that possible? And Destiny says, look, each time you're born with the knowledge of your previous life, but if you die as a child before your X gene manifests, before your powers, you know, activate, then you're not going to reincarnate. You die just like everybody else. So really, if Destiny and Mystique wanted to, if Moira decides to go down this path a couple more times, they might just say, you know what, let's just kill her before she ever has that opportunity to keep making that same mistake and become a threat over and over. So Moira, she's not exactly ready to agree to what Destiny and Mystique are saying. She said, well, what if I don't believe you? What if, I don't buy into what you've said is true? And Destiny says, well, you're a scientist. How would you go about proving something like that? And Moira says, well, I guess I test it, right? Experience it for myself in my next life, you know, try something different and see if things turn out differently. And Destiny's, yeah. So the question is, are you going to do that? Are you going to try to help our people instead of hurt them? And Moira says, well, I don't know. I haven't decided. And so they say, well, let's find out. Let's kill you now and figure out what exactly you're going to choose to do. And Moira says, but I don't want to die like this. And Destiny wants to teach her a lesson and says, well, you're going to die like this because you've lived poorly. And that's what living a poor life gets you. So she actually has Pyro burn Moira McTaggart alive. And Destiny even tells Pyro, burn her slowly so she doesn't forget how dying like this feels. And so we see Pyro does just that. So it's a pretty brutal scene. And a pretty harsh wake up to the reality of kind of the human versus mutant war that's going on. You know, the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants here is taking out a fellow mutant because she literally is working against mutants. She's literally without necessarily realizing it herself, because again, there is that level of naivete there, thinking that she can make a cure. And only the mutants that want to take the cure are going to be forced to take it. So, again, it's a pretty rude awakening and a very, in her own words, a poor death for Moira. So her fourth life begins, and obviously with the knowledge that she has gained in her previous three lives, there's much more urgency this time, right? Let me gain the knowledge as quickly as I can. Let me try to do something different. Let me see if I can change things for the better. So we're told that she throws herself into her understanding of what would eventually be called the human mutant dilemma, that idea of these two aggressive species who share the environment and evolution demands that one or the other sort of adapt and give up dominance to the other. It's the whole basis of the human mutant conflict, I guess you'd say. And so when Moira starts looking beyond her own experience with her mutant powers and how they affect her, and starts looking at, you know, mutants as a whole, she starts seeing the benefits of mutants and of the idea of having, you know, homo superior. And she starts thinking, well, maybe in this light, I need to give Professor Xavier another try. Like, maybe I was too harsh in judging him, because evolution has to come for all of us at some point. And so maybe I misjudged him. Maybe I was too quick to think about him as being arrogant. And so in this life, she sort of falls in love with Charles Xavier and embraces his dream, because she realizes that all he wants is a place for mutants to be safe. You know, at the end of the day, whatever delusions of grandeur she believed he had or arrogance was just confidence in himself that he could make this happen. He could make a safe place for mutants. So in this life, she stands by him through the rest of his days, from the beginnings of the X-Men through the time of hate and fear, which is the time of the new X-Men that we see here, through the lost decade, where we see some costumes we've never seen before for some of the X-Men, until the very end, which, as we see, just as Destiny had promised, the humans and their extinction machines, as they're called, Sentinels, came for all of them and all their children. It just seems destined to happen, even if she's not a part of it, even if she doesn't create this mutant cure as she did in her third life to sort of solve the idea of mutants as a disease or a problem. It's always going to end up with humans trying to eradicate mutants. So that change between what she believed in her third life of the mutant being a disease or a cancer, to this fourth life of her realizing that mutants are just as capable of good as anybody else. And there can be many benefits for mankind due to mutants. But seeing that the war always comes, I think that's the real turning point for her. And the rest of her lives, she spends trying to figure out a way. She never goes back, at least that we know of, to being on that other side, to trying to cure it, to seeing it as a anything less than a gift. So I think the way her third life ended and what she sees in her fourth life, with even with her teaming up with Charles and doing everything that she can to help him and still seeing mutants eradicated by the Sentinels, I think those might be the two most important lives, at least that we've seen in the series to this point, that Moira has led. What do you think, John Paul?
Yeah, because there's a, like you said, a no turning back kind of mentality that she's come out with now. She knows that there's an inherent evil amongst not only the humans, but the technology that they've created that won't stop until humans are gone. I mean, mutants are gone.
Right. So with this knowledge in her fifth life, she decides that they've got to be more aggressive. You know, mutants have met a violent end in her previous life, even though her and Charles did everything they could to protect mutants. So if they're going to war on us, then the answer is let's take the war to them first. Let's be more aggressive. And that's the only acceptable response to the violent tendencies of man. And so in this life, far earlier than any other life, she goes to America to meet Charles. She steals from the means from her parents. She runs away at the age of 13, goes to Charles, meets him a full decade before she's ever met him before, opens her mind to him and says, hey, this is the first time she's done this. Hey, look at what has happened to mutants in my previous four lives, right? She basically says, she tells him about what her mutant power is. Says, hey, gain this knowledge, look into my mind, take my memories and see everything that I've tried and everything that's happened, but it has sort of an unintended consequence. It radicalizes Charles. Charles sees that, you know, they've tried this, they've tried that, they've tried the other thing, and none of it's worked. And we all end up being dead, being exterminated by the Sentinels. So instead of establishing a school, because again, remember, he gets to start doing this far earlier than he has ever at any point. So instead of founding a school, he just starts gathering mutants to himself as sort of an army. He builds a city that's full of mutants, that has walls and protects all the mutants, and it holds back, we're told it holds back the outside world of man. But eventually the Sentinels come anyway. Bolivar Trask's adaptive learning machines came for the mutants again, and they're all destroyed. Now, in the next life, her sixth life, we don't know what happens. It's actually not covered in this particular issue. It's a whole. For some reason, we skip to life number 7. And in that life, Moira decides that she's going to eradicate the Trask bloodline so that Sentinels will not be created. If she can destroy those, it's the whole idea of, you know, going back in time and killing Hitler's grandfather, right? So Hitler never exists. So Moira thinks, if I can dedicate my life to learning how to become like this assassin, this sniper, or what have you, I'll kill all the Trasks, and Sentinels will never become a thing. Artificial intelligence will never become a thing, and mutants will be safe. So she spends years of her life assassinating Bolivar Trask, Donald Trask, Gwyneth Trask, Simon Trask, without mercy, without pity. She kills them all. Then she learns a very sort of logical thing about time and evolution and sort of life. Life happens, right? And so blood on her hands, blood in her mouth, the dark truth that she learns about these machines is that, it, in Hickman's words here, artificial intelligence is like a fire. It's not an invention, it's a discovery. And even though she killed all the Trasks, that just stopped them from being the first human to create artificial intelligence. And instead it was just somebody else. No matter what happens at that particular point in time, artificial intelligence and the Sentinels are just sort of predestined to exist. When evolution gets to a certain point, when technology gets to a certain point, when computers and artificial, in, you know, basic artificial intelligence or what have you, gets to a certain point, it just achieves that sentience. It's going to happen whether the Trasks are there or not, because the societal and environmental conditions are right for that to happen at that time. So without any hope of being able to stop those conditions, it's far too much to try to affect that level of change into society to stop artificial intelligence. And even then, even if Moira was more powerful, even if she recruited more people sooner, I just don't think, maybe they could delay it, but they're never going to be able to stop it. It's something that's going to happen no matter what. So she dies in her seventh life, and that experience of her, you know, giving her all to stop these Sentinels from existing and artificial intelligence and adaptive machines from coming into being, radicalize her, you know, just like in her fifth life, Xavier was radicalized by seeing all the different lives that the previous four lives she'd led and how mutants always come to a bad end. So now she's going to go further out. Okay, well, I can't stop it on my own by just killing the Trasks. So let's take a different tack. Let's war on the humans in a different way and kind of raise the stakes. So in her eighth life, instead of embracing Charles Xavier's dream of, hey, maybe we can either live peacefully coexist with the humans, or we can go off on our own and live in our own city. Neither one worked. She decides to embrace the necessary evil of Magneto, right? Magneto, who is much more willing to break some eggs to make the omelet, if you will. And so she goes to Magneto and she tells them, you know, all the stories of what she's learned and what she's seen in her lifetime, the war lost, their people destroyed. And, you know, Magneto believes her and he takes it upon himself to just wage a one-man war against the rest of the world to try to stop this from happening. But because Moira in this lifetime doesn't confide in Xavier, even the other mutants, even the X-Men fight against Magneto, right? And so he's just one man at the end of the day, and he falls to the combined might of Earth humans, betrayed by his own kind. In his words, you know, fools who believed in the greater human good. They didn't believe that humans would eventually hunt mutants to extinction. So that was another failure for Moira. Even Magneto, a much more militant personality, wasn't able to stop it with the foreknowledge of, hey, this is what could happen. But I think the big mistake Moira makes in her eighth life is the fact that she doesn't go. She should have gone to Xavier and Magneto both. Because if you had taken that radicalized Xavier and had him with Magneto, but I guess for all we know in the seventh life, Magneto was on their side too, and that didn't work either. But it does seem like she's grasping at straws. This one doesn't seem like it was a plan that was well thought out, that ever really had a chance of succeeding. Because as powerful as Magneto is, I don't think he can, and clearly it's proven out here, because he does fall to the other mutants and the other heroes, he's just not powerful enough to take over the world by himself. Maybe if he teamed up with Doom. Probably not. So anyway, anything to say about the end of the seventh life or the eighth, John Paul?
Well, I don't think Magneto would team up with Doom because he's another human.
That's true.
He's all about pro mutant. Yeah, it does seem kind of like a half-cocked thing. You're going to one guy and expecting him to carry you, not thinking about, and especially since you were in the past life, you knew that Xavier tried to fight for humans and mutants to coexist. Why would you go to Magneto when the numbers are not in your favor?
Yeah, exactly. But I guess you chalk it up to her just being so disappointed about her plan to kill the Trasks and think that was going to prevent Sentinels from existing. So try again, I suppose. And that's what she does in her next life. And this one, again, you just wonder, what the heck are you thinking? This is never going to work out. But in her own words here, she decides that she's tried everything else. And the only solution she hasn't tried is Apocalypse. So she goes to Apocalypse and embraces the idea of evolutionary dominance, which is what Apocalypse is all about. In that way, he believes that mutants should be the only species on Earth because they are superior. You know, he's been called a monster and he's been called evil. But again, she's tried everything else at this point. So let's try Apocalypse, because he'll wage war against humans, you know, much more so than Magneto, much more so than Xavier. This is kind of her final chance, I guess. You know, this is final boss level. But even this doesn't work out, you know, as hard as they try, and they last a lot longer. But, you know, you're talking about a war that was waged in the world over a period of years. You end up fighting over a world that's not even worth fighting over. With the machine adaptive learning intelligence of Nimrod still eventually emerging and eventually defeating Apocalypse. So what are you left with? So after all the lives lost, the end of all these wars, with the knowledge of the old ways and the old way of thinking, and nothing would ever be enough to save mutants, she decides to try something truly revolutionary. And in her 10th life, and that's not an accident, right? Roman numeral 10 is an X. She decides that she and Charles Xavier are going to break all the rules and do something very, very different. And so we go back to see seeing that scene that we saw at the beginning of Powers of 10, where there's that carnival, that fair, where Charles Xavier was sitting on the bench, and Moira comes up and starts talking to him in such a way that Charles is like, "Do I know you?" And so we get a couple of scenes here that are repeats of panels from that first issue of Powers of 10. She's talking about, you know, seeing the strong man sitting in the sun, smiling. And when Charles asks to, you know, "Do I know you?" She says, "Yeah, you very much so." And she says, "Well, Charles says, the reason I was smiling is because, you know, I recently had this most wonderful dream of a better world and my place in it." And I talked about that when he said that in Powers of 10, about how that's him coming up with the idea of the X-Men, and Moira's, you know, answer to that, which was a quote on one of the text pages, even in Powers of 10. "Well, here's the thing, Charles, it's not a dream if it's real." And him asking once again, you know, do we know each other? She says, "Yes, you know, read my mind," basically. And that's when Charles, again, great work by Pepe Larraz, with kind of the shocked look on his face as he, you know, if you thought that it radicalized him before when he was only looking at four lives, now he's looking at nine different lives. But he's also doing that. It's five more lives than, you know, only the four where, hey, things always end up poorly. Let's go and live our separate existence, which is what happened in life number five, and it still didn't save anything. Now Charles is looking at nine different lives that Moira has led, and he sees what she sees. He knows what she knows, and that's that you've got to do something different because everything she's tried hasn't worked. You know, trying to be passive and live on your own didn't work. Trying to be militant and have Magneto, you know, sort of lead the resistance movement of mutants being able to be the dominant species didn't work. Even going to the extreme of Apocalypse, waging what looks to be a decades long war based on the destruction that we see in the panels, that didn't work either. So that's the difference between this time when Charles reads her mind versus when he read it during her fifth life. This doesn't radicalize him because he knows that they need a different way. And so that's how the issue ends. We get another text page saying, "I am here. I have always been here." And that's a quote from Moira. And then on the following page, following couple pages, double page spread, it's the many lives of Moira X. And we see life 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, as I mentioned earlier, is skipped for one reason or another. Then we have life 7, 8, 9, and 10. And at various points on the timelines, we see when things have happened. For her first two lives, Moira at year 8 enrolls in the Edinburgh Academy. One thing that all lives share, all 10, is at age 13 is when her mutant powers manifest. And then, as I said, various other times, different things happen at different ages for Moira. So it's a great way to look at her lives and compare what has happened when she's died. And for some reason, we don't know the full end of life number 9. We do know that is the Apocalypse timeline, but I think there's still things to be explored there, even though it doesn't work out, because it does have a dotted line after year 42. So when Moira's 42 is when the Apocalypse War begins. We know it didn't work out, but we don't see her death notated on that timeline. Likewise with the year 10, because that's sort of the one that we're exploring now, we don't see the end of that one either. But we do have various events on that timeline that sort of match up with what we know of Moira's life in our own kind of 616 universe, like, you know, the birth of Proteus and House of X happening when Moira's 52, Moira faking her death. So things like that. When she's 47, the Moira Xavier Magneto schism. So those are all storylines that have happened in our own 616 universe. So again, this is a huge game changer. It totally flips Moira McTaggart as a character on her head. She becomes much more important, maybe second only in the X-Men universe to Professor X himself. And you could maybe even make an argument that she's more important than Professor X. So from a supporting character who I always kind of enjoyed, but certainly never considered her a mutant, to one of the most interesting and perhaps consequential. I won't call her the most powerful, because her power is passive. You know, she doesn't have control over it. She has to die. And the fact that she only has maybe one or two more lives after this, it's a finite power, which also makes it interesting. But this whole idea and what it allows Hickman to play with was a real game changer in the X universe. And it, her having the foreknowledge of all these different possibilities and timelines, knowledge is so powerful, especially for those that have the abilities to take advantage of the things you learn, like the mutants, like, you know, Professor X, like Magneto. It's a big idea that Hickman has come up with, an interesting idea. And like John Paul and I were saying earlier, it's an idea. Don't dive too deep into the nuts and bolts of how it actually works, because you can poke a lot of holes in it. But if you just take it, like John Paul said earlier, kind of at its face value, it works very well as a way to explain away so many different things that have happened, so many different ideas of the X-Men reincarnating, of, you know, X-Men coming back from the dead, of allegiances changing as people gain knowledge, as Moira comes in and says, well, we tried, you know, you're going down this path and we've tried this before. I literally have tried this before, and this is how it ends. And so you can see how it would be a way to unify all mutants. So great idea. Probably one of the best I've seen in the X sort of corner of the Marvel universe, but you kind of come to expect that from Jonathan Hickman. He's not always my favorite writer in terms of execution, but there's no denying the guy's a great idea guy. So yeah, even though, as I said, this was spoiled for me ahead of time, it's still, you know, when you actually read it and look at the timeline and have it spelled out for you, it's still very, very impactful. So I think that's all I have to say about the issue, John Paul. What other thoughts do you have?
Well, I don't know whether or not it's because I merely just forgot about it, or I saw it and didn't think about it, but Life 6 not even being mentioned, noted, that's fascinating to me. I don't know, I put more attention onto that now that you said it out loud. I guess maybe because I'm by myself and I'm not thinking out loud, so to speak. There's got to be story potential in there. There's a reason why Life 6 is not mentioned. It has to be.
Yeah, I noticed it right away, and I was like, wait, did I accidentally skip a page? What happened?
Yeah. You know, I actually think that I did notice it the first time I went through the timelines.
Yeah.
But I don't know why I haven't given it more attention than that, but yeah, that's definitely fascinating.
Yeah, I'm very curious to see. There's nothing Hickman doesn't do for a reason. So there's 100% a reason for that, and I'm very curious to see what that's gonna be. So,
Why you brought the fingerprint to my attention? You thought like maybe that was some Easter egg that he was planting?
Yeah. With Hickman, feel like nothing, he doesn't do anything for without a reason. Now, again, it fully could have just been a Pepe Larraz or Martea Garcia, you know, whichever one of them did the colors, just, you know, spreading out the ink, kind of, you know, wanting to do the using shading. The
finger.
And using their finger. I know that there are artists that do that. So it could have totally been inadvertent, but again, just because it's Hickman, I was like, I'm going to mention it because you never know with Hickman. So yeah, I'm curious. I'll have to ask him or Pepe next time I see him. I'll be like, did you do that on purpose? Pepe would probably be like, nah, that was just me sort of smearing the ink around. So, but that's kind of cool. I mean, those are the kind of things that Hickman does in his comics. They definitely make you think. And this is such a, you know, like I said, a unique idea. So, but overall, I thought the art was really great. It's not, this one is not colored as brightly. I feel like it's the colors are a little a little dimmer, a little more muted than the first issue. But I feel like that's purposeful because we're getting all these lives, you know, over and over. And this is not exactly a, you know, a happy book. It's more really struggling with gaining the knowledge that mutants are sort of destined to be eradicated, and her and Charles trying to find a way to fight against that. So I thought the color work was done very well and suited the tone of the book. And it's a lot of action. And probably the thing that I love most about the art in this book from Pepe is he really varies up the page layouts. Like the panels are incredible. There's a lot of diagonal panels. And even when we see things that are repeated, like seeing Moira in utero, he changes things around enough to keep it interesting. There's even the panel with Magneto where we learn that, you know, he himself couldn't stand against the might of all the other heroes. That whole panel itself is turned vertically. And so he does flip the camera angles around the perspective that we as the reader are seeing the story. He moves the camera around a lot as well. And so that's really exciting, keeps us as readers from getting bored. And he does, you know, repeat panels, like I said, in scenes at various times, because again, Moira is repeating her life, but he changes things up, you know, enough to where you realize, yeah, that's not the same kind of, or that's not the same life, but yet you get sort of the same feel. And so I'm sure it was a challenge, but at the same time, you know, to sort of change little subtle things to make it seem different. But at the same time, he got to use some of the same backgrounds and stuff. It probably saved him some time, at least if he works digitally, it did. So yeah, this is probably my favorite art that we've seen so far in the series. Granted, we're only three issues into the two different series, but yeah, this is a great comic. Like I could see X fans being kind of unsure about the direction Hickman was going after reading the first issue of House of X, and then definitely after Powers of 10, that first issue, they might have just been thinking, what the heck is this guy trying to do? But I can't imagine any X fan reading House of X number 2 and going, okay, I'm done, I'm not reading anymore, this is garbage, because this is groundbreaking stuff. I really do think it is. All right, I think that's going to do it. Anything else to add, John Paul?
Oh, a couple of things. Like, for instance, I really enjoyed how Pepe Larraz laid out the entire conversation between Destiny, Mystique, and Moira. Mm. It just felt so cinematic in its approach, and the angles that he chose, the way he had the expressions, even though Destiny doesn't emote with her face. Mm-hmm. Both the mixture of the dialogue from Hickman and Pepe, I thought that was just like, it was very well done. And lastly, year 9, I just got to say, is more fascinating if you get caught up with current X-Men.
Oh, that reminds me. So somebody on Twitter reached out to me, and I want to read it. And he said that when we were doing the Powers of 10, that we had made a mistake that was a real common mistake. It's not exactly what we were saying in terms of, you know, year 0 is year 1, and then X to the first power is year 10, and then X to the 10 is year 100, and then X to, you know, 100 or whatever is year 1000. It's a much more fluid timeline. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to go back in my Twitter mentions and read exactly what he said, but basically what he was saying, if I'm understanding it correctly, is he's saying that it's not a set time, which then, you know, in comics allows you to have those sort of sliding timelines like people do. Yeah. So he says, you're making a common error in the dates and powers of 10. It is scientific notation, and Hickman made it a bit confusing. It's actually years A dot B times 10 to the whatever, times 10 to the, you know, the 1, 2, 3, 4, 10, whatever. But he mucked it up so it looks cooler. It is not a hard date, and the AB is to allow fudging. So, you know, basically what he's saying is your start date isn't set in stone, but whatever the start date is necessarily, then you think about, okay, this is the start date plus 10 years. This is a start date plus, you know, X number of year, you know, or I shouldn't say X, but versus a you know, another set of years. And then that's, you know, much farther, you know, so 10 years, another big chunk of years, and then, you know, another big chunk of years, that's about 10 times what that first one was. So it's like, if you look 10 years into the future, and then you look, you know, 100 years in the future, and then 1,000 years in the future, but it's not necessarily that many years. And we don't have an exact start date because he uses AB rather than an actual number. So again, it allows it to slide forward, and, you know, just gives him more room to play. So I did want to mention that. So thanks to @SpinalCold on Twitter for bringing that to our attention. I told him we would make that correction, because we don't want to, you know, have things set in stone if we weren't understanding it correctly. So he does say that a lot of people were confused by powers of 10-1. And to some extent, a lot of people still are, because there's a lot of questions that still haven't been answered, which we talked about. John Paul, yeah, being caught up, still has, you know, many questions about it. So he thinks it's one of the best X stories, in his opinion. And he loves hearing us, me specifically, talking about it, because I'm experiencing it for the first time. So thanks to Spinal Cord for listening. And thanks to all you guys for tuning in to X Tuesdays and all our podcasts. We really, really appreciate it. So that's going to do it for this episode, everybody. Hope you enjoyed it, and we'll talk to you next time. You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.